Chapter 4. Appear to be an object of desire. Create triangles. Few are drawn to the person whom others avoid or neglect. People gather around those who have already attracted interest. We want what other people want. To draw your victims closer and make them hungry to possess you, you must create an aura of desirability, of being wanted and courted by many. It will become a point of vanity for them to be the preferred object of your attention, to win you away from a crowd of admirers. Manufacture the illusion of popularity by surrounding yourself with members of the opposite sex, friends, former lovers, present suitors. Create triangles that stimulate rivalry and raise your value. Build a reputation that precedes you. If many have succumbed to your charms, there must be a reason. Creating triangles. One evening in 1882, the 32-year-old Prussian philosopher Paul Rey, living in Rome at the time, visited the house of an older woman who ran a salon for writers and artists. Rey noticed a newcomer there, a 21-year-old Russian girl named Lou von Salome, who had come to Rome on holiday with her mother. Rey introduced himself, and they began a conversation that lasted well into the night. Her ideas about God and morality were like his own. She talked with such intensity, yet at the same time, her eyes seemed to flirt with him. Over the next few days, Rey and Salome took long walks through the city. Intrigued by her mind, yet confused by the emotions she aroused, he wanted to spend more time with her. Then, one day, she startled him with a proposition. She knew he was a close friend of the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, then also visiting Italy. The three of them, she said, should travel together. No, actually live together, in a kind of philosopher's ménage à trois. A fierce critic of Christian morals, Rey found this idea delightful. He wrote to his friend about Salome, describing how desperate she was to meet him. After a few such letters, Nietzsche hurried to Rome. Rey had made this invitation to please Salome and to impress her. He also wanted to see if Nietzsche shared his enthusiasm for the young girl's ideas. But as soon as Nietzsche arrived, something unpleasant happened. The great philosopher, who had always been a loner, was obviously smitten with Salome. Instead of the three of them sharing intellectual conversations together, Nietzsche seemed to be conspiring to get the girl alone. When Rey caught glimpses of Nietzsche and Salome talking without including him, he felt shivers of jealousy. Forget about some philosopher's ménage à trois. Salome was his. He had discovered her, and he would not share her even with his good friend. Somehow, he had to get her alone. Only then could he woo and win her. Madame Salome had planned to escort her daughter back to Russia, but Salome wanted to stay in Europe. Rey intervened, offering to travel with the Salomes to Germany and introduce them to his own mother, whom he promised would look after the girl and act as a chaperone. Rey knew that his mother would be a lax guardian at best. Madame Salome agreed to this proposal, but Nietzsche was harder to shake. He decided to join them on their northward journey to Rey's home in Prussia. At one point in the trip, Nietzsche and Salome took a walk by themselves, and when they came back, Rey had the feeling that something physical had happened between them. His blood boiled. Salome was slipping from his grasp. Finally, the group split up, the mother returning to Russia, Nietzsche to his summer place in Tautenberg, Rey and Salome staying behind at Rey's home. But Salome did not stay long. She accepted an invitation of Nietzsche's to visit him, unchaperoned, in Tautenberg. In her absence, Rey was consumed with doubts and anger. He wanted her more than ever, and was prepared to redouble his efforts. When she finally came back, Rey vented his bitterness, railing against Nietzsche, criticizing his philosophy and questioning his motives toward the girl. But Salome took Nietzsche's side. Ray was in despair. He felt he had lost her for good. Yet a few days later, she surprised him again. She had decided she wanted to live with him, and with him alone. At last, Ray had what he had wanted, or so he thought. The couple settled in Berlin, where they rented an apartment together. But now, to Ray's dismay, the old pattern repeated. They lived together, but Salome was courted on all sides by young men. The darling of Berlin's intellectuals, who admired her independent spirit, her refusal to compromise, she was constantly surrounded by a harem of men, who referred to her as Her Excellency. Once again, Ray found himself competing for her attention. Driven to despair, he left her a few years later and eventually committed suicide. In 1911, Sigmund Freud met Salome, now known as Lou Andrea Salome, at a conference in Germany. She wanted to devote herself to the psychoanalytical movement, she said, and Freud found her enchanting, although, like everyone else, he knew the story of her infamous affair with Nietzsche. Salome had no background in psychoanalysis or in therapy of any kind, but Freud admitted her into the inner circle of followers who attended his private lectures. Soon after she joined the circle, one of Freud's most promising and brilliant students, Dr. Victor Tausk, 16 years younger than Salome, fell in love with her. Salome's relationship with Freud had been platonic, but he had grown extremely fond of her. He was depressed when she missed a lecture and would send her notes and flowers. Her involvement in a love affair with Tausk made him intensely jealous, and he began to compete for her attention. Tausk had been like a son to him, but the son was threatening to steal the father's platonic lover. Soon, however, Salome left Tausk. Now her friendship with Freud was stronger than ever, and so it lasted until her death in 1937. Interpretation. Men did not just fall in love with Lou Andreas Salome. They were overwhelmed with the desire to possess her, to wrest her away from others, to be the proud owner of her body and spirit. They rarely saw her alone. She always, in some way, surrounded herself with other men. When she saw that Ray was interested in her, she mentioned her desire to meet Nietzsche. This inflamed Ray and made him want to marry her and to keep him for himself. But she insisted on meeting his friend. His letters to Nietzsche betrayed his desire for this woman, and this, in turn, kindled Nietzsche's own desire for her, even before he had met her. Every time one of the two men was alone with her, the other was in the background. Then, later on, most of the men who met her knew of the infamous Nietzsche affair, and this only increased their desire to possess her, to compete with Nietzsche's memory. Freud's affection for her, similarly, turned into potent desire when he had to vie with Tausk for her attention. Salome was intelligent and attractive enough on her own account, but her constant strategy of imposing a triangle of relationships on her suitors made her desirability intense. And while they fought over her, she had the power, being desired by all and subject to none. Our desire for another person almost always involves social considerations. We are attracted to those who are attractive to other people. We want to possess them and steal them away. You can believe all the sentimental nonsense you want to about desire, but in the end, much of it has to do with vanity and greed. Don't whine and moralize about people's selfishness, but simply use it to your advantage. The illusion that you're desired by others will make you more attractive to your victims than your beautiful face or your perfect body. And the most effective way to create that illusion is to create a triangle. Impose another person between you and your victim, and subtly make your victim aware of how much this other person wants you. The third point on the triangle doesn't have to be just one person. Surround yourself with admirers. Reveal your past conquests. In other words, envelop yourself in an aura of desirability. Make your targets compete with your past and your present. They will long to possess you all to themselves, giving you great power for as long as you elude their grasp. Fail to make yourself an object of desire right from the start, and you will end up the sorry slave to the whims of your lovers. They will abandon you the moment they lose interest. Keys to Seduction. We are social creatures and are immensely influenced by the tastes and desires of other people. Imagine a large social gathering. You see a man alone whom nobody talks to for any length of time and who is wandering around without company. Isn't there a kind of self-fulfilling isolation about him? Why is he alone? Why is he avoided? There has to be a reason. Until someone takes pity on this man and starts up a conversation with him, he will look unwanted and unwantable. But over there, in another corner, is a woman surrounded by people. They laugh at her remarks, and as they laugh, others join the group, attracted by its gaiety. When she moves around, people follow. Her face is glowing with attention. There has to be a reason. In both cases, of course, there doesn't actually have to be a reason at all. The neglected man may have quite charming qualities, supposing you ever talk to him, but most likely you won't. Desirability is a social illusion. Its source is less what you say or do, or any kind of boasting or self-advertisement, than the sense that other people desire you. To turn your target's interest into something deeper, into desire, you must make them see you as a person whom others cherish and covet. Desire is both imitative, we like what others like, and competitive, we want to take away from others what they have. As children, we wanted to monopolize the attention of a parent, to draw it away from other siblings. This sense of rivalry pervades human desire, repeating throughout our lives. Make people compete for your attention. Make them see you as sought after by everyone else. The aura of desirability will envelop you. Your admirers can be friends or even suitors. Call it the harem effect. Pauline Bonaparte, sister of Napoleon, raised her value in men's eyes by always having a group of worshipful men around her at balls and parties. If she went for a walk, it was never with one man, always with two or three. Perhaps these men were simply friends, or even just props and hangers-on. The sight of them was enough to suggest that she was prized and desired, a woman worth fighting over. Andy Warhol, too, surrounded himself with the most glamorous, interesting people he could find. To be part of his inner circle meant that you were desirable as well. By placing himself in the middle but keeping himself aloof from it all, he made everyone compete for his attention. He stirred people's desire to possess him by holding back. Practices like these not only stimulate competitive desires, they take aim at people's prime weakness, their vanity and self-esteem. We can endure feeling that another person has more talent or more money, but the sense that a rival is more desirable than we are, that is unbearable. In the early 18th century, the Duc de Richelieu, a great rake, managed to seduce a young woman who was rather religious, but whose husband, a dolt, was often away. He then proceeded to seduce her upstairs neighbor, a young widow. When the two women discovered that he was going from one to the other in the same night, they confronted him. A lesser man would have fled, but not the Duke. He understood the dynamic of vanity and desire. Neither woman wanted to feel that he preferred the other, and so he managed to arrange a ménage à trois, knowing that now they would struggle between themselves to be the favorite. When people's vanity is at risk, you can make them do whatever you want. According to Stendhal, if there is a woman you are interested in, pay attention to her sister. That will stir a triangular desire. Your reputation, your illustrious past as a seducer, is an effective way of creating an aura of desirability. Women threw themselves at Errol Flynn's feet, not because of his handsome face, and certainly not because of his acting skills, but because of his reputation. They knew that other women had found him irresistible. Once he had established that reputation, he didn't have to chase women anymore. They came to him. Men who believe that a rakish reputation will make women fear or distrust them and should be played down are quite wrong. On the contrary, it makes them more attractive. The virtuous Duchess de Montpensier, the Grande Mademoiselle of 17th century France, began by enjoying a friendship with the rake Lauzun, but a troubling thought soon occurred to her. If a man with Lauzun's past did not see her as a possible lover, something had to be wrong with her. This anxiety eventually pushed her into his arms. To be part of a great seducer's club of conquests can be a matter of vanity and pride. We are happy to be in such company, to have our name broadcast as this man or woman's lover. Your own reputation may not be so alluring, but you must find a way to suggest to your victim that others, many others, have found you desirable. It's reassuring. There's nothing like a restaurant full of empty tables to persuade you not to go in. A variation on the triangle strategy is the use of contrasts. Careful exploitation of people who are dull or unattractive may enhance your desirability by comparison. At a social affair, for instance, make sure that your target has to chat with the most boring person available. Come to the rescue, and your target will be delighted to see you. In The Seducer's Diary by Soren Kierkegaard, Johannes has designs on the innocent young Cordelia. Knowing that his friend Edward is hopelessly shy and dull, he encourages this man to court her. A few weeks of Edward's attentions will make her eyes wander in search of someone else, anyone else, and Johannes will make sure that they settle on him. Johannes chose to strategize and maneuver, but almost any social environment will contain contrasts you can make use of almost naturally. The 17th century English actress Nell Gwynn became the main mistress of King Charles II because her humor and unaffectedness made her that much more desirable among the many stiff and pretentious ladies of Charles's court. When the Shanghai actress Jiang Qing met Mao Zedong in 1937, she didn't have to do much to seduce him. The other women in his mountain camp in Yan'an dressed like men and were decidedly unfeminine. The sight alone of Jiang was enough to seduce Mao, who soon left his wife for her. To make use of contrasts, either develop and display those attractive attributes, humor, vivacity, and so on, that are the scarcest in your own social group, or choose a group in which your natural qualities are rare and will shine. The use of contrasts has vast political ramifications, for a political figure must also seduce and seem desirable. Learn to play up the qualities that your rivals lack. Peter II, Tsar in 18th century Russia, was arrogant and irresponsible, so his wife, Catherine the Great, did all she could to seem modest and dependable. When Vladimir Lenin returned to Russia in 1917 after Tsar Nicholas II had been deposed, he made a show of decisiveness and discipline, precisely what no other leader had at the time. In the American presidential race of 1980, the irresoluteness of Jimmy Carter made the single-mindedness of Ronald Reagan look desirable. Contrasts are eminently seductive because they don't depend on your own words or self-advertisements. The public reads them unconsciously and sees what it wants to see. Finally, appearing to be desired by others will raise your value, but often how you carry yourself can influence this as well. Do not let your targets see you so often. Keep your distance, seem unattainable, out of their reach. An object that is rare and hard to obtain is generally more prized. Reversal. There is no reversal. It is essential to appear desirable in the eyes of others.